With the COVID-19 pandemic, what power do states have to restrict travel, and what would be the impact of it? Professor Buzz Scher joins me to discuss. This is The Legal Impact, presented by the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law, now accepting applications for JD graduate programs and online professional certificates. Learn more and apply at law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, the stay-at-home orders across the states raises many concerns. Do individual states have any power to control people from crossing borders?
They have some power. And, you know, the short answer, as always in these things that are complicated, is it depends. You know, it depends what the reason is for them having a ban on people entering the state. If the reason is a version of economic discrimination primarily to interfere with interstate commerce, then it's going to be unconstitutional. There's a U.S. Supreme Court case several decades old early to middle part of the 21st century called Edwards versus California, where California at the time, I think it was during the Depression era, had a law that said poor people, basically migrants who didn't have a place to live and didn't have jobs, were banned from the state. And in Edwards versus California, the U.S. Supreme Court said that violates the Commerce Clause. That's unconstitutional. So on the other hand, there's another U.S. Supreme Court case where during a period when yellow fever was of concern and a ship docked in New Orleans, and New Orleans banned the ship, wanted to dock in New Orleans, and New Orleans had a ban on the ship docking there. It had people on it, Americans and others, who wanted to get off. And they banned it for public health reasons. And the Supreme Court said, that's okay. So in short, yes, probably, but it's a pretty dramatic an expensive measure. If you think about the border between New Hampshire and Massachusetts,
there's countless roads. I mean, it's impossible to cover every road.
Exactly. And you know, that's true. Less roads in Vermont. We've got the convenience of a river separating Vermont and New Hampshire, which reduces the number of roads. A good number of Maine, New Hampshire also. So, you know, it's in theory that could probably be done for public health reasons, but it's practically speaking, it doesn't make sense.
And I'd imagine if they decided to do it, I mean, right now it's, if they decided to move to indefinitely, it would probably very quickly end up to the Supreme Court, I'd imagine.
Eventually, yeah, it would. And there might be a fast track. I'm not hearing that any states are deciding to do that. You know, what states are doing, and it varies. New Hampshire, the governor has issued an advisory to stay at home. And this is the key distinction as you look at this happening around the country. Has the governor used his or her police powers to ban people from going outside, and is somebody who goes outside, are they committing a misdemeanor under the laws of that state? If so, then the police can stop cars that are outside. They can stop cars with Massachusetts license plates and kick them out of the state. That's not happening. Because right now the governor's executive order is an advisory, and there is no crime being committed if you are not abiding by the advisory. And it's a pretty broad advisory. You can go to pharmacies, you can go to hospitals, you can go to grocery stores, you can go to doctor's appointments. You know, there's a lot of, you can go to work if you fit in the many types of businesses that are identified as essential. So at this point, it's not the kind of lock. It's not a lockdown where the governor could, excuse me, in theory, mobilize the National Guard to enforce a lockdown. We'll see whether we get there or not. You know, the one of the benefits, quote unquote, of living in New Hampshire in these times is the population is less dense.
Right.
And, you know, you look at what's happening in the major urban and metropolitan areas or the highly populated states. It's a much bigger, it's much more difficult to control even people, to control people going out. Even if you have, you know, if you have a shelter in place advisory, with a million people, with a population in a city of 9 million people like New York City, but you're allowed to go out to grocery stores and doctor's appointments and essential workers can go to jobs. That's a lot of people still going out.
Yeah, it definitely is.
So, you know, I don't know when we go, if ever we go to a formal lockdown when it's a crime to leave the your house and the National Guard is called in to enforce it. My guess is it's unlikely to happen in New Hampshire. You know, depending on how things play out, you know, the National Guard may be activated at the state level. At the federal level, you can only use National Guards for natural disasters. So it really, the language really isn't there at this point to use it for at the federal level. To have the president use it for public health shutdowns. It's used for hurricanes and floods and the like. But at the state level, governors can have that power. So, in a, you know, to step back and look at it more broadly, that this is a public health emergency gives state governors a lot more power in managing the situation and ordering or issuing advisories or issuing orders. That's the long and short of it.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the episode description to Professor Hodder's podcast I did a couple months ago before all this really went down to the severe levels, because she did a good job summarizing how the state of New Hampshire specifically was already prepared for a lot of this with a lot of legislation and just in general logistical prepping that they had.
They are. And that's the good news.
Now, when it comes to commercial transportation and various other economic implications to it, are there more, would it be even harder for states to regulate?
Yeah, and I don't know that they want to. I mean, they can order that businesses shut down, and they can, you know, and like restaurants and the non-essential businesses, you know, they can to some extent monitor that. I don't know, as an economic matter, whether they want to shut down like commercial trucking companies who are moving food from warehouse to a grocery store. You know, so it's there's not a one size fits all on this. That's, you know, that's the real struggle. Fortunately, most states, they have laws in place that give governors a lot of flexibility in trying to manage what we're going to shut down, and still, it's not a matter of keeping the economy running. Depending on, it's more of a matter of keeping the essential businesses running, so that people can get food, so that they can get health care, so they can get those essential things that they need. They can get, they can go to the pharmacy. So it's a matter of managing the shutdown to keep the essentials going. You know, you look at, for example, you look at the governor's advisory and identification of what's what are essential businesses and who are essential workers, and it's 9 pages long.
It's so long. I saw the message. I'm like, oh, this keeps going and it keeps going. It gets very specific, but there are a lot of industries that are still staying open, or are, especially with the ability in 2020 where people can work from home. I mean, we're dealing with technical implications of that happening, but I mean, we're doing this via Zoom conference right now.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's a good example, but you think, you know, you think of all the pieces that are required to be operating to get food, to get vegetables from California to New Hampshire, to a warehouse in New Hampshire, and then distributed to all the grocery stores in New Hampshire, and to have the grocery store stocked, and to have the cashiers there, and to have the cleaners there. And, you know, one, you take just one little thing and you begin to realize how complicated it is just to keep the food supply running, and not to mention healthcare. And then, you know, you look at another problem that I've been working on is jails. You know, jails are what I would call mandatory cruise ships.
Yes.
You know, it has all the dangers of cruise ships and how quickly stuff could spread, number one. People are in there without, but not by choice, other than the staff. And they, while the jails I've talked to have screening procedures for people who are coming in, who've been sentenced or coming in pre-trial, they don't have testing available.
Right.
You know, all their screening is, do you have symptoms? And if you don't have symptoms, it doesn't mean you don't have the virus. It just means you don't have symptoms yet. So it's a really difficult circumstance to, you know, and that's a whole different bundle. And to go through managing that, you know, the superintendents in the state have some authority to do stuff on their own. In some circumstances, depending on the inmate, the courts and the prosecutors need to be involved. The governor can't tell jails what to do. Jails, he can order the head of the State Department of Corrections to do certain things, but the jails, the houses of correction, are county institutions and run by the county commissioners. And so, you know, I've just described a whole bunch of different lines of authority for a really difficult situation.
Yeah, I mean, and these lines of authority carry over to other industries or sectors severely. I mean, we talked about healthcare. I mean, this has been one of the issues with regards to testing being widespread across the U.S. and regulations that come with that.
Yeah, so what, in terms of testing, you know, boy, we may in many areas in this country, perhaps not in New Hampshire, but in many areas of this country, we're going to be rationing testing. You know, we want to test the healthcare providers, right? We want to test people, certain types of essential people that we need out there. But given that jails and prisons are mandatory cruise ships, don't we want to test people when they're entering those facilities? So if they test positive, they can be isolated. So what's the priority list of who gets tested? Well, early on in this, it was rich people and celebrities. That sure seemed to be the appearance. I think that's not as much the case anymore. I think a lot of people took a lot of heat for that. But it tells you what a incredibly complicated webs of authority lines, of people, of businesses, of individuals it takes to just provide healthcare, to just feed people in this kind of pandemic. It's the downside of being such a complicated, highly developed economic and social entity in the United States. I mean, it's stating the obvious, but boy, the complications of being so big and how we manage that and how we sustain ourselves in the kind of crisis that has existed for millennia. This is, you know, other than natural disasters like earthquakes and floods and hurricanes, this is the kind of disaster that has been around for millennia. You call it the bubonic plague, you call it smallpox, you call it polio, you know, you call it yellow fever. You know, it's been around forever. And the more complicated the society, the more developed the society, the more we rely just on so many different parts of the economy just to get through a day, to eat, to have the internet, to heat our house. It's harder now to manage this than it used to be.
Thanks for listening to The Legal Impact, presented by the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. To help spread word about the show, please be sure to subscribe and comment on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Also visit the show page at law.unh.edu/podcasts. On that page, you'll also find a listener survey. Be sure to fill that out to tell us what you like and what you want us to cover in future episodes.